The following lecture was delivered at the 17th Annual National Jewish Retreat in Palm Desert, California, a project of the Rohr Jewish Learning Institute. We hope you enjoy it. We encourage you to visit jretreat.com for information on upcoming retreats. Mrs. Rachel Schmuckler now presents her lecture, In Search of Authenticity.
There's a story of the Alter Rebbe, the author of the Tanya, the founder of the Chabad movement. He was sitting with his young grandson in his lap, and the little boy said to his grandfather, Zayde, Zayde, grandfather, grandfather. And the Alter Rebbe looks at his grandson and said, where is Zayde? Remember, he's sitting on his lap. The little boy points to his grandfather's head and said, here is Zayde. And he said, no, that's Zayde's head, but where is Zayde? So then he puts his hand on his grandfather's heart. And he said, here is Zayde. And he said, no, that's grandfather's heart. But where is Zayde? And again, he feels different parts of his grandfather. And he gets the response, this is one part of me, but where am I? The little boy slides off his grandfather's lap, goes to play, and pretends to get his finger caught in the door. And he screams, Zayde, Zayde. And his grandfather says, what is it, my little one? Comes running. And he said, there is Zayde, I found you. This little boy found his grandfather with great wisdom, but one moral of this story is that it's not so easy to point to one part of ourselves and say, this is me. There is a famous children's story about a forgetful boy who is afraid he's going to forget his stuff. So what does he do before he goes to bed? He writes everything down on his list. This is where I put my clothes. This is where I put my hat. Here's my belt. He wakes up in the morning. He looks at his list. He finds all his stuff. And then he realizes, I don't know where myself is because I didn't write myself on the list. And the truth is that happens to all of us because at one moment we're the most kind, noble, generous, godly person, and we want to think of ourselves that way. And then another moment we are less than noble if we're going to be kind as we say it. And then we turn around and look at ourselves in the mirror and say, where am I on that list? There doesn't seem to be any authentic way to respond to this challenge. How does the Alter Rebbe answer this question? The Alter Rebbe starts off his book of Tanya like this. Tanya, it has been taught, an oath is administered to him before birth, saying, be righteous and don't be wicked. And even if the whole world tells you that you are righteous, consider yourselves to be wicked. The Talmud is telling us that before we're born, our soul has to swear. You're going to be a righteous person. You're not going to be a wicked person. And even if everybody looks at you and says, here is a righteous person, don't consider yourself righteous. Consider yourself wicked. Wow. Did you hear that statement? How are we supposed to make sense of that? So many questions to ask about that. The Alter Rebbe himself asks a lot of questions about this statement, including an important question, bringing up a Talmudic dictum that seems to be contradictory. The Mishnah says, "Va'al tihi rasha b'fnei atzmecha," do not be wicked in your own eyes. How does he respond to this question? The Alter Rebbe says like this. This is a novel insight. This is a groundbreaking realization. He introduces us to a novel idea and a new aspiration, and it is the Beinoni. Who is the Beinoni? He is not a righteous person, and he is also not a wicked person. In order to understand who the Beinoni is, we first have to define what a tzaddik is. The Alter Rebbe, calling upon classic Jewish sources, describes the tzaddik, the righteous person, as somebody who was able to eradicate the evil within themselves. The tzaddik is a person who has no inner voice of evil to contend with. And who is the racha? The wicked person, he's somebody who does have an evil voice to contend with and unfortunately gives in. How often he gives in is about how wicked he is. And who is the Beinoni? So he's not a righteous person and he's not a wicked person and he's not a happy medium between the two. Like a wicked person, he has evil thoughts, temptations, desires. But like the righteous person, he never channels any evil. His every thought, speech and deed is a reflection of his godly essence. So what we are made to swear is, think of yourself in this way. Yes, you are always acting like a righteous person. And everyone looks at you and says, here is a righteous person. Here is someone who always channels divinity. They never channel any evil. That's not our measuring stick. That's not how we decide if we are righteous. Just because the whole world tells us that we're righteous, that's not how we know. Of course they tell us that they're righteous because they only see our behavior. But they don't know what we have to contend with in an inner space. So this is a battle we have to engage in every single day. And why do we have that struggle? Where does this struggle come from? The Alter Rebbe, quoting the holy Kabbalist Rabbi Chaim Vital, introduces us to a novel concept. We have not one soul, but two souls. This is a huge realization for those of us who suffer from feelings of hypocrisy. It's not one soul coming up with good ideas and bad ideas at the same time, which would truly make for a confused and self-contradictory personality. There are two complete souls vying for our identity. We're accustomed to thinking of us having two inclinations, the Yetzer Tov and the Yetzer Hara. We do have two inclinations, but these two inclinations are part of a larger picture. They are just the drives of our two opposing souls. If it was just about the two drives, it would be mainly about our behavior. The fight would be about our behavior. The animal soul, which the Yetzer Hara, would try to get us to behave according to our temptations and follow worldly desires. The Yetzer Tov would get us to try to behave always in accordance with the Torah. But now that we're talking about two souls, two complete personalities with complete intellectual and emotional array, they are vying for our identity. They don't just want the way we behave. They want our essence. They want our feelings and our feelings and our understanding to be aligned with them. So this is a groundbreaking realization, and I'm going to summarize what we said up until now. That ever-present human struggle is not a product of hypocrisy. It's the side effect of having two complete souls. Now that we have an idea of the challenge and the players, let's explore, did humanity ever experience a time with no inner conflict? And indeed, we did. Once upon a time, back in the day, in the Garden of Eden, the entirety of humanity consisted of two human beings, Adam and Eve. And they had no force inside of themselves of evil. You know who Adam and Eve were? They were human beings who totally identified with their mission in life. They and their mission were one. Their entire sense of self was their divine mission. But once Adam and Eve ingested from that tree of knowledge of good and evil, evil became an inner force to contend with. The Torah tells us that Hashem clothed them in kusnais ar, clothing of skin. And Targum Yonatan, the famous translator of the Torah, the greatest student of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, explains that Hashem took that skin off of the snake, famously known as Mashcha Dechevia, the skin of the snake, and clothed Adam and Eve in that skin. That skin was the klipa, that outer shell and husk, we can call it a facade, and now it became their clothing that they started to identify with. This snake skin was really just an outer self, and they started to feel it as it being their very self. Instead of feeling that their self was their divine mission, they started to feel a sense of independence and apartness from Hashem. Once upon a time, we and our missions are one. We had no consciousness of self apart from our divine mission. But now that we're clothed in that skin snake, we start getting confused and entangled, having all these ideas that are separate from us, and considering them to be our true selves. They tell a story from the Hasidic master of Simcha Bonim of Peshischa. So there was this very wealthy nobleman in Poland, and he had a beautiful, expensive horse, and he loved that horse so much, he was so afraid someone's gonna steal it. So what did he do? He built a barn like a fortress, and he hired a watchman, and he said, watch my horse, don't let anybody steal this horse. He put iron padlocks on that barn, and He went to sleep for the night, but he just couldn't sleep. His horse kept popping into his mind. And he's thinking, I bet you that watchman fell asleep. I mean, it's pretty late, so I'm going to go check on the watchman. So he goes and he checks on the watchman, and he finds the watchman in a pensive state. He's thinking. And he said, what are you thinking about, my dear watchman? And he said, you know, I'm thinking about when you knock a hole into the fence, where did that material go? He said, wow, such a genius. This is what he thinks about in the middle of the night. These kind of cosmic problems are going to keep him up all night. I have nothing to worry about. Goes back to his bed, and still he can't fall asleep. I guess today he would be diagnosed with insomnia. Said, my horse, I bet you someone stole the horse. I bet you the watchman fell asleep. Goes back, and there he is, his brilliant professor of a watchman. Again, looks like he's deep in thought. And he said, what are you thinking about now? He said, I'm thinking about a very important question. When you eat a bagel, where does the hole go? Wow! Have you ever heard of such a genius? He's so excited. He got a professor for a watchman. He's going to be up the whole night. Goes back to sleep, and what do you know? For a third time, he can't fall asleep. Goes running to the barn, and here is the watchman, and he's really, really agitated now. He seems like he must have the whole world on his mind. He said, what are you thinking about now? He said, please don't be upset at me, but this is the problem that's boggling my mind. You have built a barn like a fortress. You have locked it up with iron padlocks. You have hired a watchman to stay up all night and guard it, and yet the horse has disappeared. Well, we all know how the horse disappeared. The watchman was thinking about everything else besides for the horse. And that's what happened to us. Once we got that skin, the snake skin covering over our divine consciousness, our thoughts become so confused and we start to identify with our animal self as being our real self. So let's summarize what we said until now, and that is that before Adam and Eve ate from that tree of knowledge of good and evil, they and their mission are one. They didn't need any clothes because they had no sense of self or apartness from Hashem other than what they were. But you have a question? I'll get to it at the end of class, is that okay? But once they ingested the knowledge of evil, that bliss was over. Now they had this independent sense of self. And Hashem's question to Adam was, Ayaka, where are you? And indeed, that became Hashem's question to mankind, as the Alter Rebbe, when he was imprisoned, famously told the guard, the interrogator, that Hashem questions each of us and all of humanity at any given moment, Ayaka, where are you? The battle is fierce. It's not about some behaviors here and there. It's literally about our identity. An animal soul and a godly soul are vying for our identity, and the question becomes, where are we? Who are we? There's a story of the previous Rebbe where two chassidim from Odessa came for private audience. And one was in the waiting room, the other was meeting with the Rebbe, and the one in the waiting room couldn't help but overhear the conversation. The previous Rebbe asks the chassid, tell me, how are things in Odessa? And he said, oh, I have to tell you, Rebbe, you'll be so happy. Jewish life in Odessa is thriving. The house of study is always here, stands of study. There's prayer going on all the time. Yes, there's some challenges, but we're always working on it. We have people that are going and teaching people about Hasidus. They're introducing them to the joy of Yiddishkeit. Things in Odessa are beautiful. The previous Rebbe was so happy to hear that report, and he warmly thanked the chassid and gave him 2 rubles. His friend overheard that conversation, and he felt very disturbed. How could his friend fail to tell the previous Rebbe of all the moral looseness that was prevalent in the time in Odessa? He thought, he's going to tell the previous Rebbe the truth. So, when it was his turn, the Rebbe asked him the very same question. Tell me, how are things in Odessa? And he said, Rebbe, I have to tell you the truth. It's a very big challenge there. The young people are falling prey to the moral looseness that big city life has to offer. And the previous Rebbe ended the conversation, and he didn't give him anything. And he looked at the Rebbe and he said, but I told you the truth. I don't understand why my townsman, who gave you this raving report, which was sugar-coated, got 2 rubles, and I, for telling the truth, I get nothing. And the previous Rebbe looked at him and said, don't you think I know what's going on in Odessa? I know what's going on in Odessa. The question, the reason why I ask you that question is because I want to know, in which Odessa do you live? And you know, we have two realities within us, but the question, Ayaka, to us is, which city, which reality do we identify with? There's a story about someone riding a horse at breakneck speed, and someone along the ride sees him and he yells out to him, "Where are you going?" And he said, "I don't know, ask the horse." That's not the way it's supposed to be. Our animal soul, we need it. It's our horse, it's our pet, we need its power, but we need to harness it. There needs to be a rider with higher vision. How do we get there? It sounds really good, but let's face it, we identify with the animal soul. That's our natural self. So the answer is, the process begins with education. So much emphasis is placed on education. Why? Because knowledge is so potent. You know how they say you are what you eat? You are what you know. The ideas that you know, study, pervade your mind, and they change the way you think and feel. In fact, that is the method of the Tanya. Chabad, Chochma Bina Da'at, wisdom, understanding, knowledge. Let your intellectual understanding create your emotional reality. When I was a little girl, I used to play at my friend's house a lot, and her mother had all kinds of interesting books on the bookshelf, and one of them was a book about heart health, and on the cover of the book, there was an ice cream with a big cherry on top, and somebody who really liked ice cream might have their mouth watering. So if you open that cover, you read the inside, and it says, what appears to be ice cream in an ice cream cone with cherry on top is actually blood strenuously working to push through a coating of fat in an artery. If you first were tantalized and mesmerized by that picture, now you had a feeling of disgust. Knowledge changes our awareness, and our awareness changes the way we feel. All we need is a fresh view of things, a deeper insight, and not only does our awareness change, but our feelings change. So here's our education and our new realization. We have not one soul, but two souls. They not fight not just only of our behavior, but they fight over our very identity. And who is the animal soul? It's just our pet. All it really wants is pleasure. And when it realizes that the greatest pleasure is divine pleasure, then it becomes another force for good. So that's a great start. It may heal us from feelings of hypocrisy. It's not just one person acting two different ways, but it's actually a divine soul cloaked in a facade which has now become the conduit for its expression. That is the way things are now. In order for our divine soul to express itself, to act upon the body, it cannot act without the medium of the animal soul. Anytime we're doing something godly, you know who's involved? Our animal soul. So now we understand that the state of affairs, but how does that help me? Because practically speaking, my animal soul often feels a lot more authentic to me. That's the real me, and that's a good question. It depends on what level of reality we see things at, okay? So our animal soul feels natural, and so it's easy for us to call our animal soul our real self. Why are we calling our divine soul our real self? And we have to look at things and say, well, which perspective are we looking at it from? Is it about what is natural and easy, or is it about what is true and authentic? If it's about what's natural and easy, well, it's the animal soul, right? It's the animal soul is, I'm hungry, I'm tired, I want, I'm mad, I. That's the animal soul. But our deepest soul is our divine essence. As the Alter Rebbe describes it in the second chapter of Tanya, it is truly a part of Hashem above. It's our core, our essence, it's limitless, it's powerful, it's the life within our life, and it is the one that is sometimes trapped within the animal soul and doesn't even have a voice. Now, that might be true since the beginning of time, right? When Adam and Eve were cloaked in that snake skin, they had an understanding that my divine core is my real self, or we hope that they had that understanding, and my animal self is my fake self, but humanity has moved along since then. Time has progressed. As time has progressed, we have identified more and more with our animal soul. And so I need some more insight into this. How does this reality play out? How are we going to say that our divine core is our true self? So let's look at chapter 18 in Tanya, where the Alter Rebbe proves the greatness of the Jewish people, not from our righteous ones our scholars, our noble people. He proves the greatness of the Jewish people from our scoundrels, our thieves, our immoral people. That's how he shows us that we're great. What does he say? He says that at a moment of truth, if a Jewish person was put to the test, either turn your back on Hashem or give up your life, they will give up their life. And throughout history, sadly enough, this has replayed again and again. People who lived not a religious life, not even a moral life, brought to forced conversion, for the most part, they chose death. They died. One such story is the story of Yussel the Holy Thief. In Berdichev, there is a gravestone inscribed, "Here lies Yosef Haganav HaKadosh, Yussel the Holy Thief." And what's his story? He was an out-and-out thief. He was stealing all the time. That's what he did for a living. And then he thought, "Am I foolish? I'm stealing from petty thievery here and here. The church has a really huge treasure. I'm going to steal that." So he went and burglarized the church. And in those days, the mid-18th century, punishment for that wasn't just thievery. This was sacrilege. And so they said they're going to put him to death. And they said, "Listen, you can save yourself. We're going to reduce the charges from sacrilege to thievery. Even that we're going to forgive if you convert to our religion." And he said, "No way. I'd rather die." They lit the fire beneath him. They said, "You have one more chance." And he said, "I am Yussel the Ganav. I'm Yussel the thief. I have committed many sins in my life, but I would never turn my back on the one God." And with that, he died. And we can say, okay, that was true in the mid-18th century, but how true is that today? And in fact, Rabbi Adin Steinsaltz was once teaching these concepts to a class, and that question came to him. Okay, that was true in the olden days, but I don't know if that's true today. And he admitted he didn't have an answer. The next day, he went to lecture in a very secular crowd, and he thought they need some stirring up a bit. You know, they're so complacent, they're so apathetic, and he started to say some really harsh things to them. One young man at the back of the crowd stood up, and he was indignant, and he said, "I may not be religious, my parents are not religious, grandparents left the religion long ago, but if somebody would tell me to bow down to an idol or die, I would gladly give up my life." He was shocked. It was the next day, and this was his answer. Yes, the Jewish override mechanism still operates in the Jewish soul. A Jew always wants to be attached to Hashem. That is our deepest yearning. That is our aspiration. We want to be connected to Hashem, and we never want to be ripped apart from Him. And what we desire defines who we truly are. There's a story of a merchant with his wagon driver, and they were caught by thieves. They stole everything, and they were ransomed by the Jewish community. As soon as they were ransomed, an argument broke out between the two of them. What was the argument? Each one of them said, "I am the merchant, and that guy is the wagon driver." Really, who cares? But the Torah says, and we actually just read it in Shul, "Dei machsayre ashar yachsar lai," according to his lacking, which he lacks. Whoever is the one who needs more money is the one who gets more money. The merchant, who had a huge thriving business, should have gotten more support from the community than the wagon driver, who needs less money for his business. Couldn't figure it out, so they bring the case to the old wise rabbi, and he said, "You guys, this is so complicated. I can't figure it out right now. We'll have to deal with this tomorrow morning. But for tonight, let's just get you guys comfortable and settled. Tell me what it is that you need to get comfortable." So the first guy says, "Please, I need a toothbrush, I need shampoo, I need a good shower, I want some fresh linens." And the other guy says, "Please, I need a swig of beer, black bread, and herring." And the rabbi looks at them and he says, "Case closed. That guy with the shower is the merchant, and that guy with the beer is the wagon driver." How did he know? Because what we wish for tells us who we truly are. And what does a Jewish person wish for at a moment of truth? They yearn for connection to Hashem. And that teaches us that our deepest self is our divine self. Okay, that sounds very good, but how do we access that on a day-to-day level? And that's a good question. We really have to ask ourselves, how does the divine soul find expression at all? Remember that the divine soul is literally part of Hashem, part of the divine reality. How does that find expression in this material world? And the Alter Rebbe tells us in chapters 4 and 5 of Tanya that the only way the divine soul finds expression is through Torah and mitzvot. Torah and mitzvot are a phenomenal reality. The entire world is a world of klipa. That means a world that hides its divine essence. You look at the world, you don't see that it really is just Hashem. You know what this whole world is? B'dvar Hashem shamayim na'asu. By the word of Hashem, the heavens were created. This whole world is just literally the word of Hashem. And yet we look at the world and we see it as an independent reality, something that can even oppose Hashem. It's a world of klipa. There is nothing that totally exposes Hashem, not in this world, and even in the higher worlds, because any world is a place of concealment. In Hebrew, in order to say world, we say olam. That is from the word he'elem, concealment. A world, by default, is something that conceals Hashem. And yet there is one breakthrough reality that is total exposure of the divine, and that is Torah and mitzvot. Why? Because Torah and mitzvot are the will and wisdom of Hashem. And Hashem's will and wisdom are He Himself. We are not the same as Hashem in this regard, or in many regards. We are created in the divine image, but our will is separate than us as much as we identify with it. Our wisdom is separate than us. Hashem is but a simple unity. The Maharal of Prague says He is Pashut B'tachlis HaPshitus. That means simple as simple could be, utterly simple. So when we say the will of Hashem, when we say the wisdom of Hashem, we are saying Hashem Himself. Torah and mitzvahs are Hashem Himself. They are breakthrough through the reality that hides Him. And that is how the divine soul finds expression. Remember, it is a part of that divine reality. So the intellectual aspect of the divine soul finds expression in the Torah, and the emotional aspect of the divine soul finds expression in the mitzvot. Okay, so there are the essential component, but how do we relate to that? Back to the same question. There's an animal soul that's easy to relate to, although, don't get me wrong, we don't relate to it and feel good about it. It's just that we naturally relate to it. And I'll give you an example. Let's say your child is throwing a terrible tantrum and you are so mad. And all you want to do right that at that moment of your feeling, your inner frustration, is yell. If you give in, do you feel good about it? I don't think so. We'd rather side with our deepest essence, with our higher self, and treat our child kindly and with firmness as needed. And then we feel like we've accomplished something holy and important. So here's how we relate to our divine self. And this is what the Alter Rebbe teaches us in chapter 12 of Tanya. Most of us will never be able to completely vanquish our animal side. That is the province of the tzaddik. But there are propitious times that we can grab onto and experience freedom from the conflict and turmoil, such as, and this is a quote from chapter 12, during the recital of Shema or the Amidah, when the supernal intellect is in a sublime state. Kabbalah teaches us that our mind is influenced by the sublime mind at any given moment. And when that supernal mind is broad and flowing, and that is during the time of morning prayers, it is easier for us to take what we know and feel it in our heart so that we identify it with it. And true, once prayer is over, we no longer have access to that higher level of consciousness, but there are two things that we can call upon. And again, this is from chapter 12 in Tanya. One is that a human being, by nature, their mind rules over their heart. And second of all, light banishes darkness. So when faced with a challenge, we know that our heart is under the dominion of our mind. And when it comes to matters of holiness, we have an additional advantage, additional edge, and that is the advantage of light over darkness. Whenever we decide, that's it, I'm going to pull through with this holy thing, we're always going to win because light naturally banishes darkness. So let's summarize what we said until now, and that is that Torah and mitzvot are the channel for our deepest self. At the time of prayer, it's a special opportunity to experience an amazing level of clarity. And even when that window is closed, we can always call upon the advantage of heart over mind, and when it comes to matters of holiness, of light over darkness. But even as we employ this advantage of heart over mind, light over darkness, we might turn around and ask ourselves again, am I being authentic. The bottom line is, I still have a dark side. Despite all the goodness that I express in speech, thought, speech, and action, my struggle with evil is still as real as ever. So am I being authentic? In order to answer that question, we have to define authenticity. How do we define authenticity? In chapter 13 of Tanya, the Alter Rebbe discusses it. Let's look at the Mishnah. How do we know if something is real? The Mishnah calls waters that dry up once in 7 years as being lying waters. Even when we see them flowing right now, they are not real because they dry up once in 7 years. Something that is not predictable, something that is not consistent, is a lie. It's not true. So when you call a table, is that true? Today it's table, tomorrow it will be, but what in about in 100 years from now? Is that true? So it's a table for now, but that's a limited truth. And even a million years truth is nothing before God, your Lord, is true. At the pinnacle of reality, there is only one truth, and that is Hashem himself. What does the prophet Yirmiyah say? He says, "V'Hashem Elokim Emes," God, your Lord, is true. And Maimonides says that he alone is true and no other entity possesses truth that compares to his truth. That's what the Torah says, Ein Od Milvado. There's nothing else besides him, meaning besides for Hashem, there's no other true existence like his. So that's the absolute unwavering truth, the only thing that exists forever, that is Hashem. The Alter Rebbe tells us in chapter 13 that while truth is absolute, there is a core of truth in every realm of reality. So if you're a righteous person, you are completely authentic. Your outer, everyday behavioral self is completely aligned with your divine core. Every thought, word, and act always channels the divine. You are a channel of Hashem, the ultimate truth. Everything about you is truthful. It reflects that truth. But if we're a person who still contends with evil, we still have a dark side to contend with, then am I authentic? You can ask yourself, are you authentic? And the answer is, you can be. The key to our authenticity lies not in the fact that we are always in touch with our deepest self, but that we have a space that we can always access that we know will be there. And that space is created through daily prayer and meditation. It means that we know that when we get to that space, we're gonna feel the reality that there's nothing else besides Hashem. We need to create that. Every day we need to meditate and pray and think about the fact that Hashem is the only reality. We think about his greatness. We think about our divine core being one with him. That puts us in touch with our deepest space. Then we go about the rest of our day and we may not feel it, but we know that every day it's reliable there for us. So is our truth true? Yes, but also no. We still relate to our animal self as being an experience of ourself, but it doesn't mean we can never experience what a tzaddik does. And the Alter Rebbe gives us an exercise in chapter 14. How do you feel what a tzaddik feels? So who is a tzaddik? A tzaddik is somebody who is totally in love with Hashem. He feels this passion of Hashem in his heart and hates anything that's evil. That's the natural corollary. When you love someone or something, you hate anything that opposes or wants to hurt what you love. So the tzaddik naturally abhors evil. What about the rest of us? Do we abhor evil? I mean, we wish we did, but sadly we don't. Can we train ourselves to think like a tzaddik? A tzaddik never has to psych himself up to love Hashem. We never have to psych ourselves up, or most people don't have to psych themselves up to enjoy a good dinner. It's just, the food is there, they're hungry, that's what they relate to. But there's an exercise that we can think of that can help us see what the tzaddik does, and that is, our sages say, who is a wise person? He who sees that which will be. The Alter Rebbe tells us, look at all those things that you find pleasurable, all the dainties of the world, realize how they will disintegrate, rot, become a pile of filth. Can you see things past the immediate moment and see what they will lead to? It will help you develop a healthy sense of disgust for things that you might be drawn to against your better judgment. I mean, for example, walking through the toy store, if you're somebody who loves to buy toys and you know you shouldn't, think about what a mess and clutter this is going to be at some point in time, how all these toys are going to be broken, how they're going to take up too much space. And you can start thinking, hey, This actually, even right now, is disgusting. Or advertising agencies put so much to fuel human desire. They want us to see the attractive, enchanting side of their products, of their clients' products. Can we train ourselves to see what is not in the ads? Let's think about how this is going to be disintegrated, how it's going to rot, how it's going to lead to things that just become filth and ruin. And it helps us think like a tzaddik thinks. So let's summarize what we said until now. We've given our divine soul expression through Torah study and mitzvot. We created an oasis of daily prayer, a place where we can connect to Hashem reliably on a daily basis. And we also practice seeing through the facade of the world, as the tzaddik does, realizing that materialism for itself really isn't as wonderful as it seems to be. But now we're in the battle rink. My mind is there, but how do I feel what my mind understands? The Alter Rebbe gives us incredible insight and an exercise to practice in chapter 44. He says, after you meditate, use your voice to feel your emotions. What does that mean? It means first you meditate about Hashem. Think about his greatness. Be astounded by him. Feel your love for him, and then verbalize what you feel. The Alter Rebbe keys us into such an important point, and that is when you talk about your emotions, you feel your emotions. So after meditation, take the time to feel it by speaking about it. And yes, we might be artificially simulating these emotions. Remember, we didn't feel it until we started to talk about it. And we can ask ourselves, I'm so doubtful. I don't know. Is this real? And the Alter Rebbe addresses this truth, speaking to the truth seeker from a higher vantage point, looking at reality in its depths. And he says, you might initially think that your feelings are imaginary, but don't worry, because it's the absolute truth by virtue of your hidden self. That's who you are inherently. There's an analogy of these people who used to sell elephants. They were selling gray elephants, and one day they discovered brown elephants, and they realized that brown elephants are bringing in a lot more money. So they started to, as they brought the elephants over the border, the tax patrol realized that these people are getting more money for the brown elephants. So they started to charge a higher tax for the brown elephants. That wasn't very good for business. So people started to paint their brown elephants gray so they wouldn't have to pay the higher tax. And as soon as the border patrol caught on, they started to hose down elephants as they crossed the border, making sure that they were indeed gray elephants. So one day they were hosing down a gray elephant, and it turned brown. And as the water kept pouring, the elephant turned gray again. And what happened? The man first painted his elephant gray. And then he painted his elephant brown. And then he realized it wasn't so ethical, so he painted his elephant gray. He didn't know he could wash the paint off, and then he sees the paint coming off, he realized that the outer layer actually matched the inner layer, and that's us. We often identify with our animal selves, and we feel like our higher selves is the self that we've painted. But the truth is, as we continue to align our thoughts, speech, and action with our deepest essence, one day we begin to feel that that's who we were all along. There's an incredible story of the Talmud. This is a story of the great Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, Judah the Prince. He was one of the greatest Jewish leaders of all time. He was the redactor of the Mishnah. His childhood friend was the son of the great Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, Rashbi, the author of the Zohar. Rabbi Elazar was his childhood friend, and one day he visited Rabbi Elazar's town. Rabbi Elazar was no longer alive, and he asked, does this righteous man, did he leave a son? And they said, indeed, he left a son, but I have to tell you, he's a very handsome boy, and he's very immoral. He lives a very immoral lifestyle. And that hurt Rabbi Yehuda very much. Could you imagine? This is the son of the great Rabbi Elazar. This is the son of the great Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. And this is the lifestyle that he leads. And listen to what Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi did. He took the boy with him, and he gave him smicha. He ordained him as a rabbi. And then he brought him back, and he put him under the tutelage and guidance of the boy's maternal uncle, Rabbi Shimon ben Issi ben Lakonia. Now, the boy wasn't very comfortable in his new lifestyle, and every day he would say, that's it, I had enough, I'm going back home. And one day, his uncle looked at him and said, you have been made wise. They cloaked you in a golden cloak when they ordained you as rabbi. They gave you the title rabbi, and you say, I want to go home? And the boy thought about it for a minute and he said, you know what? I vow that I'm going to abandon my ways and stay. And indeed, he became a great Torah scholar. One day he was in the base medrash of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, Jew to the prince, and Rabbi Yehuda hears a voice and he said, that sounds like the voice of Rabbi Elazar ben Reb Shimon, my colleague, my childhood friend. And they said, indeed, that is his son. Now let's look at the story. I mean, Rabbi takes this boy who doesn't seem to be fitting to be a rabbi. He seemed to have imposed a character upon him, and yet the boy, in acting in accordance with that character, ended up becoming an example of nobility, of courage, of change. That outer self, which seemed to be superimposed, was actually his real self. So really, what's the point? Why should we find ourselves and bring our deepest self to the fore? We're talking about what's our deepest self. We've established our divine self as our deepest self. It's our truest self. It's the self that we are. And yes, we have an animal self. That's the self that we naturally relate to, but it's not our real self. It's our pet. It's our painted self. It's our fake self. It's our facade. It's the snake of the skin. Okay, but it's easy. It's easy to relate to our animal soul. Why should we try to bring our deepest self to the fore? At a very basic level, it feels good. That talks to our animal soul too. When we live a higher life, when we're in line with our deepest self, we actually feel better. On a deeper level, it gives us the opportunity to fulfill our mission in life. Why were we born? We were born to bring divine awareness and divine manifestation to this world. And that begins in our own small world. In our animal soul, within our body, we align it with the divine. And at the highest level, it brings great pleasure to Hashem. And as the Alter Rebbe teaches us in Tanya, what every Jew really wants at their deepest base is nothing but to bring pleasure to Hashem. You know who a Jew is? A Jew is love for Hashem. You want to ask yourself, who am I? You are love for Hashem. So how do we tap into that? One thing is creating an internal space of meditation and prayer that's available to us every single day. Also, to practice thinking like a tzaddik and abhorring evil. Another tool we have is to meditate upon Hashem's greatness and verbalize our deepest feelings of love for Hashem. And most importantly, we need to study the Torah and keep the mitzvot. They allow us to access our deepest self and channel the divine into this world. That's why the world was created. The Alter Rebbe tells us in chapter 36 of Tanya that Hashem created this world because he had a desire. He wanted a place which totally obscures him to become a place which totally manifests him. When we live this kind of life, we create a home for Hashem. We achieve this by aligning our body and animal soul with a divine will, channeling divinity into this world by keeping Torah and mitzvot with love and awe for Hashem. So here's a story. My husband is the dean of a rabbinical seminary, and one day a phone call comes in from a young couple that wants to donate a car to the school. Okay, fine. Turns out that this couple lived not too far from us. She was traditional, he was an atheist, and they ended up eating Shabbat dinner with us almost every single week. I have to tell you, the conversations at that table sometimes cause indigestion. It was so feisty, and even in the winter when Shabbat comes in early, our dinner would go sometimes past midnight. It was fun, I have to say. But at one point, he was still an atheist, but he decided he's going to come learn sometimes in the yeshiva. He would come in and learn in yeshiva, and he clung to his atheist beliefs. Say there's no such thing as God, and it was very convenient at the time. He was studying at UCLA to become a doctor, and one day he confided in my husband that he just doesn't know how he's going to do well on his tests. And my husband said to him, you told me you don't want to put on tefillin, I understand, but Google tefillin and acupuncture, and you'll see that tefillin enhances brain flow and increases mental clarity. At that point, he was willing to try anything, so he put on tefillin. One day, my husband asks him, Michael, how's it going with tefillin? He said, what do you mean, Rabbi? I put tefillin on every single day, and I put on tefillin on other people whenever I get the opportunity. Rabbi, tefillin is a lot more than increasing mental flow and clarity. Tefillin is connection to the divine. You can think when Michael put on tefillin for the first time, he put it because he wanted good grades on his exams. That doesn't sound very authentic to me. But on the other hand, it was the most authentic thing he could have done at the time because he was allowing his inner soul, his inner self, to find expression despite the fact that his outer self resisted it. Michael today and his wife, they have beautiful children that Baruch Hashem go to Jewish day school. They live a religious life. And I'm sure Michael still struggles with the rest of us, but he's reached a higher space of aligning his deepest self with his expressive self. So are you worried about being a hypocrite? Then don't give in to your animal soul. That's when we're actually being hypocritical, when we betray our deepest essence, our divine soul. And we never have to be worried about being a hypocrite when we are doing the godly thing, because take the Alter Rebbe's word for it, and I quote, "He need not be concerned because it is intrinsically the absolute truth by virtue of the hidden love. By aligning our behavior with the love that we have, we can once again access our deepest space. So may our hidden love be revealed. May our essence always shine. May we realign heaven and earth with the coming of Mashiach right now."
Please visit myjli.com to learn more about JLI's multiple educational offerings.